Can you imagine what it feels like to be a Canadian soccer player as Peter Pendergast blows the whistle? It's official. Canada 2000 Gold Cup champions. How does that sound?
You're listening to the Northern Football Podcast with Peter Galindo and Thomas Neff.
Yes, it's episode 32 of the Northern Football Podcast. I'm Peter Galindo, and welcome back, Mr. Thomas Neff. I missed you, buddy. I know Peru beat Chile, but that's still no excuse to skip a recording like you did on Monday.
Hey, listen, let's not talk about that. That was last week. They beat Paraguay. No, I just had too much stuff going on. And thank you to Alex for filling in for me as well. What a historic night that was. But before we get into all of that, I just want to say something. I think our fans, Peter, are the best fans. We're number three in the Apple podcast ratings behind ESPN and The Guardian, two companies that have millions of dollars, and we started this. And we're still on a shoestring budget of zero. So just want to say that. We had our best week in terms of plays, and we've reached 15,000 total plays. So I just want to thank everyone from the bottom of my heart, and I'm sure you feel the same way, Peter.
I do, and especially because when we decided to do the individual post-match episodes, I was nervous because it's such a short turnaround. You only have a couple of days to listen to those shows between games, but the numbers have stayed basically the same regardless of the frequency, and I just want to thank everybody, like Thomas said, for tuning in and you know, obviously sending in your questions, and we got plenty of them on this show. So let's not waste any more time. Let's take care of some business before we do. The Northern Football Podcast is partnered with Northern Tribune. For all your Canadian soccer news, check out northerntribune.ca and follow them on Twitter at North Tribune. Also, please subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. If that platform of choice is Apple, then why not give us a rating and review as well while you are at it? So yes, Canada 4, Panama 1. It was a rocky start for Canada, but a scintillating finish as they wrap up the October window with a resounding victory at BMO Field last night, which we were both present for, Thomas. That gives Canada 10 points in third place, two ahead of fourth place Panama, and five up on fifth place Costa Rica, who they are going to face in Edmonton next month in a double match window as opposed to the three match windows we have been used to. It's also the fourth time in the Ocho that Canada has come from behind to claim points. That's now six obtained from losing positions. We also saw perhaps the greatest goal we've witnessed in a stadium, and maybe ever, after Alfonso Davies sprinted about 70 to 80 yards, weaved his way through Panama's defense, and then finished off a terrific goal. And that is where we will start with our listener questions. Many different ways we could go with this, Thomas, because Stefan Jordan asked, was the Davies goal one of the best individual efforts you've ever seen? Darren in Ottawa asked, is it the greatest Canadian goal of all time? Darren Feledichuk asked a similar question in that regard. Where would you put that Alfonso Davies goal when it comes to the best goal scored for Canada, as did Cassidy Dankochik? Thomas, just simply put, I mean, where would you rank that goal in terms of the ones you have seen in the stadium, and then just in terms of the greatest scored by a Canadian for the national team?
Well, I have to say, I mean, if that didn't make the SportsCenter top 10, then I don't know. I don't know what the editors are doing there. What an effort. Incredible run by him to keep it in play, confuse the defender, took it right under his legs and confused the goalkeeper, locked him in to one side, put it in the other, and he was running incredibly fast. And this is what happens when you have time and space and the best left back in the world playing up front. As I've said multiple times, I think he's better suited up front. Yeah, it's incredible. For me, in stadium, has to be the best goal ever, for sure. In terms of CanMNT goals, I would say top five, just because the significance of the goal, as opposed to how nice the goal was. I think, you know, the 1986 World Cup, and you have the Gold Cup. But yeah, I think that's definitely top three, top five in Canadian history for sure.
Yeah, the only ones I can think of that maybe come close that I can recall, either whether I was in the stadium for it or I just watched it on TV or, you know, whatever, in terms of pure wow factor, I recall a Marcel de Jong free kick against Jamaica. I think one of Kyle Larin's first goals for the national team, I want to say against Dominica at BMO Field, what was also just a worldie, really, a golazo, as it were. And the Richard Hastings goal against Mexico in 2000 was lovely. Now, it wasn't the same solo effort that we saw from Davies, but the overall sweeping move on the counterattack, what was scintillating to watch. And I mean, it was obviously a massive goal in the history of Canadian soccer, so it meets all of that criteria for sure. We also got a question here from Michael Friedland. Is the Davies goal a Puskas contender? You would have to say it has to be in the conversation now. But obviously, this game, Thomas, it was the Alphonso Davies show. And even against Mexico, and at times against Jamaica, as rough as that game was, he was making things happen. And that led to a debate on, I believe it was ESPN Deportes, which I'm sure you saw, where they were basically asking, who is the best player in CONCACAF? And some of the Mexican media on that show were saying, like, Jesus Corona, they were saying Chucky Lozano, they were throwing out all kinds of names. Keylor Navas, who I think is a certainly an honorable mention and certainly up there for sure.
Yeah, and they didn't mention him. What's up with that?
Exactly. And you know, Hercules Gomez, a former U.S. international, actually walked off the set just in pure frustration at the fact that Jesus Corona's name was mentioned. But Aru Jan asked us, can you tell ESPN FC that Alphonso Davies is the best player in CONCACAF by a mile and don't compare him to Pulisic and Corona? Is there any doubt now? Is he the best player in CONCACAF, at least right now?
I would have to say it's close between him and Navas. Chucky Lozano is still very close. Mm-hmm. Pulisic has dropped his stock quite a bit. But Tito Corona, I mean, what's going on with that? I mean, the guy has not looked good as of late. I think the Mexican media likes to throw names out there. But I think it's close between him and Navas for sure. We saw how important Navas was to Costa Rica in this window.
100%, 100% we did. And he's playing for a big club, much like Davies is. Even though, you know, Gianluigi Donnarumma came into PSG, Navas is still getting quite a decent run of games and is doing fairly well. But certainly outfield players, it would have to be Davies right now. No doubt about it. And, you know, as I said, just the fact that You look at that game yesterday, outside of the goal and the assist, four shots, completed 7 of 9 dribbles. He had 2 key passes outside of the assist for Davies, or for David, excuse me. And even against Mexico, he had an assist, 3 key passes, 3 for 5 on the dribble, making things happen. And he's doing it in the big games for Canada, which is what's really important. And when they need him the most, he's showing up. And his vision and creativity is improving as well, as you see him drift in centrally more often, which I think is crucial, because not only is he getting the goals, he's also creating the chances as well, as we saw from the outset against Panama.
Yeah, 100%. And I think it helped him a lot that Canada made 5 changes to this 11. And obviously, talking about that Jamaica game, a lot really didn't happen. And I was expecting maybe Canada to look a lot like the Mexico game, especially, you know, playing at home in their own field. And they looked very comfortable. I think Davies playing with David helped him a lot. 100%. I think that maybe if David was playing up front and Davies was playing backwards, as a left back, sorry, I think maybe it would have been difficult for David to activate himself. And again, maybe David was able to really get into new areas. And Tejan Buchanan, I thought maybe there was a doubt there that Herman would give Liam Miller an opportunity, but Buchanan has executed better in big moments, as Miller has, as we saw him. He could have scored that goal against Jamaica.
So let's dive into this then, because you brought it up. Stefan Jordan asked, did Alphonso Davies cement himself as a permanent striker from here on out? Or is he going to shift back to left wing back when Kyle Larin returns? Now, I know you want to see Davies up front as much as possible. I feel like this is going to be a bit of a dilemma, Thomas, when Laren comes back, but you also don't have to play your best players all the time. I suppose the consolation is you have some very good options to rotate in and out of the 11 when those triple match windows come back, provided all of them are available again. But would you like to see Davies up front from here on out?
Yes, I would, 100%. His impact up front is so much better. And I would like to see informed Cavallini before we have the conversation of rotation for him specifically. But again, Kyle Laren is indispensable, and so is Junior Hoilett. So when they come back, you're not going to be able to fit all of them in the trio. So maybe Davies has to go as a left back. Again, we still really haven't seen that left side with Davies and Buchanan. Maybe remember Herman has another go at that kind of partnership. And like you said today in the show with Sportsnet 650, that trifecta of Davies, David, Buchanan might be sort of not a permanent trio for Herman, but something that he'll like to stick with. But I think it's difficult because Hoilett has 13 goals for the national team because of the 0-0 draw against Jamaica and because of the 1-1 draw against Mexico that came off Osorio's goal and, of course, Osorio's midfielder. You saw that the forwards were drying up there, and now that, you know, he finally gained some, regained that chemistry, that Herman might want to stick with that.
It's possible, and I think the mention of Junior Hoilett is key here because obviously he picked up a late knock against Jamaica, just before the game against Jamaica in training, and then wasn't deemed fit enough for the match against Panama, so he went back to Reading, and so he wasn't available. That's another name you have to consider in amongst the trio for the future, but again, the fact you have five or six legitimate options to start in those positions, and obviously Davies can play as a wingback if you really want him to, that is a luxury. But in terms of whether he should play there, it really depends on the game state. I legitimately thought prior to yesterday's game starting, when we saw the lineups, that Davies was going to be a wingback and Buchanan would partner David, with Osorio kind of drifting in behind them when necessary, same with Waterspoon. And from the start, it was apparent that Davies was going to be playing up front because he was not dropping back really at all. Like Larea and at times Waterspoon were responsible for that left-hand side. And he was making things happen. You could just see the interplay with him and David, as you touched on. It was working, and for the first time in this window, David was freed up as a result. And kudos to David for getting his goal, ties him for fifth all-time on the all-time national team scoring list with 17 goals, level with Toussaint Ricketts. But I think when you're at home, Thomas, and you're facing a slow defense like Panama's, who, by the way, was one of the best defenses in the region before last night when you look at some of the numbers, and then you deploy him like that, that is going to be a major, major weapon, especially with other guys like Buchanan or eventually Hoilett or Laren on the pitch with you. I suggested partnering David and Davies up front on Waking the Red before the Mexico game. And in the end, it really worked out because as a team, Canada posted 1.8 expected goals, most of which came in the second half. And Davies and David were responsible for about half of it combined, which is what you want to see from those two. So clearly that partnership works. They've spoken many, many times about how much chemistry they have on and off the pitch. John Herdman mentioned it after the game last night. David needs a partner because he's not an out-and-out nine, as we saw throughout his tenure with Ghent. Even with Lille, he's not an out-and-out nine. So this is how he is best deployed. Whether that's with Laren, whether that's with Buchanan, whether that's with Davies, he needs a partner with him. So that's why putting two up front, maybe with someone, you know, drifting in and out from one wing to the other could be useful. And then keeping three in the midfield could be useful. But certainly when Laren returns and Hoilett returns, you may have to bench one of those guys. And that's fine because that benefits you in three-game windows, Thomas.
Yeah, 100% does. And now in this upcoming window in Edmonton, you'll have two games. So it's going to be less opportunity, perhaps for less matches, obviously. But again, you have six options, like you said, and only three spots up front. And with Davies and Buchanan, who can play as a wing back, potentially four, and then Cavallini and Hoilett coming off the bench, which is always a nice plus. And I'm not sure if it's, you know, part of the lineup at all, but I just checked the FIFA rankings, and Canada has cracked the top 50. Another incredible milestone. Which, like you said, was expected.
Yes, exactly. And that's going to help further with UK work permits for certain guys who have been national team regulars for the last year or so, because I believe it's 70 or 75% of the total minutes for the calendar year for the national team. Those players can more easily obtain permits to play in England. So maybe certain guys, like, who knows, Richie Larea, Mark Anthony Kay, et cetera, could get moves to the championship, or, you know, who knows, right? So things like this help, and the more Canada rises, more and more players will be eligible for that work permit. Moving on then to another major storyline, which was the altercations during and after the game between Panama and Canada. It started just before halftime when Danielle Henry was kneeling by the corner flag just before halftime. Panamanians took offense to this, and then a fracas ensued with all the substitutes rushing over. And I mean, there was no, you know, fists thrown or anything like that, but, you know, definitely things got heated. And then post-match, they tussled again on two occasions as Richie Larea was allegedly spat at, according to Gareth Wheeler of One Soccer. And Larea actually confirmed this on Twitter in response to Wheeler's tweet. So there's at least something to that. But we did get questions, and I think we're always going to get these kinds of questions, Thomas, when it comes to officiating and just the antics you see in CONCACAF. Spin at Spinels Can asked, when will enough be enough for these referees? Cleats to the back of Buchanan, inappropriate chants from Mexico, and spitting on Richie Larea, as well as numerous non-calls throughout, yet nothing has been done. And then Van S at Vans underscore Jets asked, tinfoil hat time, is there bias towards Canada by the refs? Some fans of other countries don't take us seriously, and sometimes I don't think the refs do either. So what do you make of all of that? The altercations plus the officiating on Wednesday night.
I felt that obviously the match, 26,000 Canaman T home record at Toronto and BMO Field, it was electric, Peter. It was very, very passionate. Mm. And the Leafs were playing. Home opener.
Also true.
They were playing also in downtown. And the fact that, you know, 26,000 people chose to spend their night watching a Canada game, a World Cup qualifying, instead of going to the Leafs game or watching it on TV, a city that craves hockey and not soccer, that's a start. And the atmosphere itself was incredible. And yes, there's this North American sports culture, but when there were booing, like Alex Mejia became public enemy number one.
He did.
And again, when the benches were cleared, yes, it's not the same sport sort of, you know, feel because people are booing and stuff like that. But it did feel like the fans really like embraced soccer as their first sport in that moment, because they were booing the Panamanian players, they were booing the refs, and the reffing was absolute bullshit. Again, we're getting CONCAF'd. In the first half, there was about four questionable penalties. I would say half of those were slight contact. The other half wasn't a penalty. But again, even for those two other ones that, you know, there was some slight contact, you could make the argument that it was a PK. I wouldn't say that all of them were. Definitely not. But again, just this reffing, I'm convinced almost that it's the worst in any region.
Well, I looked into this because you figure an MLS official, and they tend to be quite card happy, right? And they tend to call persistent fouls all the time. So I looked up Armando Villarreal's stats to see if there was any sort of difference between how he officiated a CONCACAF match compared to an MLS match. Now, I don't think these numbers are completely up to date, but Armando Villarreal has given out in 14 MLS matches on the Pro Referees website an average of 4.6 yellows on average. He had five yesterday, but two were at the very end, and you could see moments where bookings were more than justified and would absolutely 100% be called at the club level, but were not yesterday. And that goes for both teams, really. But more often, it usually benefited Panama not to get the bookings. And listen, when this happens, it really doesn't help in terms of the product in CONCACAF, because if they want their best players available, then referees need to start dishing out cards early and stamping out any BS that they see, because the hard fouls are nothing new and players will get seriously hurt if it continues. So that's the only way you're going to be able to protect the players, is if you cut it out right from the start, because if you give these players an inch, they're going to take a yard or a mile, right? And you don't want to see that. And certainly Panama might have earned the benefit of the doubt, which I think some teams in this region do, and Canada will have to deal with it until they're in a position where they benefit. And they might have on the Davies goal, because I'm not too sure if the ball went out, but it is inconclusive, so give them the benefit of the doubt in that regard. These things could even out over time, but no doubt it's frustrating, especially when you're not used to it either, Thomas. Like, it really is maddening.
Yeah, like you said, again, this time it's not going to come and hurt us in the butt. But it could, may as well have. I mean, if Canada didn't win this game, if we drew this game and it didn't go the way it did, we could have easily looked at those two penalty kicks that there was significant amount of contact and said, hey, look, why wasn't this called? But again, you have those kind of calls that the ball was on the line, almost out of the line, and it did benefit Canada. And it's interesting because I think Adam Jenkins tweeted this out. I think the fourth official told Herman, like, he would have called that PK, just completely undermining the first official's authority. But that's incredible. But yeah, someone will have to get to the bottom of that. But yeah, I mean, the thoughts about just CONCACAF refereeing, I mean, Canada is not a giant in the region, and so this kind of treatment will not be new. But in the end, I think they're doing okay. I mean, with managing their expectations, I still think the yellow cards are too much, in my opinion. Because it does hurt Canada in that regard, missing key players from, you know, fouls and everything. But we have the depth to deal with it. But again, it's not something that you want to have to deal with every 2-3 games while you have players out with suspensions because of yellow cards.
And to wrap this up, we got a question here from at Kenter 16. Why didn't Panama get off the field? Talking about after the match. Very curious. Some kind of protest. No, they were actually doing their post-match prayer after the game. They gathered around the center circle and were kneeling and then, you know, saying their prayers. But curiously, when Canada finished applauding the fans in the supporter section and then were walking off, Panama stopped, quote-unquote, their prayer, got up and walked off the pitch at the same time. And then that's when the second altercation after the game ensued again. So, I mean, it really is just classic housery, really. And I mean, kudos to Canada for overcoming it and dealing with it relatively well, given the circumstances, because listen, I've played in some heated 7-a-side matches and some, you know, heated 11-a-side games myself. Imagine playing under those circumstances and with those stakes, I would probably crumble myself. So, I mean, kudos to them for dealing with that for sure. You listeners also asked some other pertinent questions as we wrap up October and look ahead to November. Before we dive into that, the slow starts, Thomas. We've said it so many times, but that could have gone a lot differently if Panama wasn't playing their third match of the window with little rotation and Davies didn't go off like he did, right? And when you look at the fact they have 4 trips coming to Central America and still big games against Mexico, the U.S. as well, that could really hurt them if that continues. Kudos to them for coming back and getting points in those situations, but eventually that's going to come back to haunt them, will it not?
Well, it hasn't so far, but it's been close.
Kind of did against now, Honduras, to be fair. They probably should have won that game.
For sure, for sure. Aside from that game, I mean, Canada's taking care of business at home. But again, Honduras is dead last right now. So I think a lot of situations are very circumstantial, to say the least. Here's where I go with this is, like you mentioned, being Panama didn't rest a whole lot of players. Only made one change. Freddy Gondola coming in for Rodriguez.
Right.
And when you have that, and you already have players who have already played 180 minutes, with the exception of one player, pretty much, and then you're going to play, you know, another 90 minutes. Because here's the thing, Panama lost against El Salvador, so they had to win against the U.S., which put them in a bad situation in a way. You know, it's sort of those like strategic matches, like the ones that, you know, Herman earmarked and said, we have to win these games, we may be able to rest here, and then we have to take care of business at home, as he said in the past. In November, I think that changes a little bit, just because it is two matches.
Correct, yeah. So you don't have to worry as much about rotation and certainly travel for Canada, because both games are going to be in your hometown of Edmonton, Alberta. So that's an added benefit as well. J-Step at Josh Stefan 5 asked, do you think the Panama fans will take revenge on our team in Panama for embarrassing their team 4-1? To that, Thomas, say what you want about Panama, but if Canada does have another slow start in Panama City, that'll be a challenge. Look at the U.S. over the weekend. There is a reason Panama has taken a point against Mexico, beaten the U.S., and are 13 unbeaten in home qualifiers.
Yeah, definitely. Can I just say something? When I was being interviewed by Panamanian television, mm-hmm. I said, quote-unquote, Panama beat a U.S. B-side, which was fair. It was true. You know, they had no Zach Steffen, McKinney, no Tyler Adams, no Pulisic, no Sargent, etc. And the comment section was just belated.
Oh boy!
Which is, you know, it was just crazy going,
buddy.
But again, I thought it was a fair result. Maybe this is payback for what happened when Panamanian fans went to the Canadian hotel perhaps. Mm-hmm. But again, like you say, this Panama team is very good, and kudos to Christensen, because yes, he has players that are playing in leagues like Uruguay, Bolivia, Slovakia. Not the best leagues in the world. Definitely not. I mean, probably tier three if you want to put it that way. But he still has weapons. He still has weapons, especially players in MLS, a couple in MLS, a few playing for some important clubs in South America, especially in the second division of Spain, which I personally think, if you were to include second divisions, I think it's near in the top 10.
For sure.
Surely, arguably. So I definitely think that you're right. I mean, Panama didn't draw Mexico for no reason and didn't beat an U.S. team for no reason. Although, obviously, you know, U.S. rested their players, but they still, a lot of those guys that played still won the Gold Cup. It's still 100% on merit. But these slow starts need to stop happening. And I think it might. But again, there was just that one game off where five starters didn't play the previous game, and maybe there was just some miscommunication on the field.
Very possible, for sure. Stefan Jordan asking, is Richie Larea better off playing in the midfield so he doesn't have to worry about leaving Kamal Miller on an island? Or should Derek Cornelius or Scott Kennedy have more of a look in that position? The latter two will absolutely get looks in that position. Cornelius had a pretty solid return against Jamaica, I thought. And Scott Kennedy, as we know, when fit and available, will be an option at left center back. Here's the thing with Larea, though. He is confusing in this regard, because if you look at that Mexico match, he started at left wing back, looked very good on both sides, probably one of his best defensive games I've seen him play in a national team shirt. And then he starts in a similar position, you know, against Panama. And I think with Davies going up front, and with him and Wotherspoon combining, he had a lot more attacking responsibilities. And when that happens, he's a bit more disobedient tracking back. It improved when he moved to the right, but it hurt Kamal Miller yesterday in the first half, because Miller isn't the most explosive guy, and he fell right into Panama's trap in the first half. Barcenas and Blackburn executed give and goes to Murillo. Miller would push up 2-1 on Barcenas or Blackburn, and then that freed up the flank for Murillo to run into, because Larea was still caught high up the pitch, and then that's what led to Panama's goal. But he's so good going forward, and that cross for Buchanan was terrific. But when he has those attacking responsibilities, that's when it comes back to hurt him. And that's why wingback is a solid role for him, because in certain situations where he's the guy who has to form the back four, then he has to be a little more responsible in that regard. But when he has more of those attacking responsibilities, that's when it lands him in trouble.
Well, majority of the time in that Mexico game, he played, he played a position. You know, he's not a left wing back, although he can play there. So he played a position and he did a steady, fine job. Maybe a more balanced role for him. Obviously, he goes up the pitch a lot, and it has helped Canada, and he's been very effective there. But again, just goes back to the whole Davies thing. Since he's more of a winger, a wing back, playing attacking role most of the time, his defensive role still needs to be included in that description. And again, sometimes when he's so attacking minded, it hurts him, you know, just because, you know, has to, whenever there's a counterattack of sorts, he has to defend. And same goes for David, you know, still needs to defend. And I'm sure the defending will improve over some time, but not if you address it.
But and this is one of the downsides with putting Davies in that striker position and then having Larea defend that entire flank, because then he has even more responsibilities. Because the one difference from the Mexico game to the Panama game was, because Davies was mostly sticking to the left, then you had a little more protection for Larea, and because they were pressing so high, that's an extra body to put pressure on an opponent, and then you don't have as many chances down your flank. So that also helps. So maybe that's the way to go. But when you have so many things you have to work out, eventually you have to make sacrifices. And given that Canada seems to thrive in chaos with their pace and technique, maybe that's the trade-off from here on out. But you have to expect to concede chances in that regard. It may not always be perfect. Into some more minutiae here. Rich Forrester, what's your opinion on Wotherspoon starting this match? What did he bring to the team? Thomas, you and I talked about this as we were leaving the stadium. I know you had some thoughts on this. I might give you a rebuttal, so you may present your case.
The only thing I have to say was already what I said in the beginning of the show. It did make sense that he played in that match because Kay was already exhausted, 145 minutes, so he was already... Like, I think Alex, our good friend Alex, he posted a really interesting tweet, and he made three colors, red, yellow, and green. And he would put it based on fitness level in terms of minutes. Mm-hmm. And again, McKay was in that middle point, but still, you know, getting tired. So he did need that rest. So he needed to make a change for sure. A rested Eustaquio is always a bonus. And Osorio playing at home, you know, he was still going to make it to at least the 50th, 60th mark, which he did around there. So that's that. Coming out for K, you had three options. One of them was Wotherspoon. At first, when Fraser came on, I thought that Herman had Fraser over Piet in the pecking order for the midfield. I thought perhaps Piet could have offered more on a defensive role, but offensive role, I think it's no questions, Wotherspoon. And all I will say is that if Wotherspoon would have put away those two chances, the score might have been 6-1, even 7-1 if you include the clear penalty. But again, I thought much like Liam Miller, great game, just didn't execute. But I think he still deserves his chance to start the odd game here and there.
But see, I disagree with you slightly. I think he executed in parts. In terms of finishing off the chances, no, he did not. But I also don't think that's his major responsibility. His major responsibility in that game was because Larea had that entire left flank to himself. And keep in mind, this was Wotherspoon's first start since June for Canada, I believe. He had one very good curling shot in the second half. He was making runs in behind the defense on that left side, which Canada sorely lacked on Sunday, and Herdman pointed that out after the draw against Jamaica. And Wotherspoon was also playing as like a third striker of sorts. He was dropping deep, hitting in quick passes to Larea open on the left. He completed 21 of his 24 passes. And then after hitting those balls into Larea, he was then looking for the overlaps or trying to get between the Panamanian defense to get to the byline and then hit it in. So I thought he did that decently well. And in this kind of a game where it becomes a little frenetic and chaotic, I think Wotherspoon really thrives in that. And I thought it was a decent enough return to the 11 overall. So for that, I definitely give him a passing grade, but it could have been exceptional if he had put away one of those chances, especially that curling effort in the second half, which was very, very close to going in. On a similar theme, Thomas, Dan Clark asked, Kayan Eustaquio, didn't ask, he said, Kayan Eustaquio need to be on the field at the same time as long as both are fit. No question, just stating the obvious. I thought the K substitution really changed the match in favor for Canada. You feel like it was already shifting in their favor, but then once K came on, that was pretty much it.
Yeah, he definitely was very good. And something really quickly on your previous point. Hi to David Witherspoon's brother, who's a weekly listener to our show, Ian Witherspoon. So thanks again for all the good vibes. I think Eustaquio, I would love for him to, again, not only move up to a bigger club, as he much deserves, but him not play as a six, you know, most of the time. But him and Kay are just so they connect so well that it's almost a matter of like, well, you know, you take Osorio out and Atiba's back, and it just becomes very, very difficult. Do you prioritize familiarity or do you prioritize individual experience here? Because Osorio still has more caps than both Eustáquio and Kay. But again, it's about, for me, it's individual performance. And if Atiba's back and if he's fit and healthy and he's good to go, he's 100% having that captain's armband and he's starting from the get-go. But that's the thing, right? It's just there's just so much competition and sometimes big decisions that have to be taken.
Kay and Eustáquio have the chemistry, and that is massive because you can see they're just on the same wavelength all the time. It allows Eustáquio to play in those deeper positions and then progress the ball from deep, whereas Kay takes care of business further up the pitch. But you knew Herdman wasn't going to start both Kay and Osorio for a third straight game. One of them was going to come out and then eventually replace the other, which is what happened. Say what you want about Kay's turnovers and risky passes. I know some listeners aren't a fan of that, but you do need that ball progression. And he transformed the midfield when he came on. I thought he had very good moments against Mexico and against Jamaica. The pitch probably didn't help him in that regard against Jamaica, but I thought overall changed that match for Canada for sure. Like, he basically put the exclamation mark on there. Even the inaccurate passes were at least the right idea. And that is what you need in those kinds of games. Overall, I thought that the midfield was pretty solid. Even Osorio, who I've been critical of, was decent. Didn't pull the strings and was bypassed a bit easily at times in the first half when he was pressing, but was otherwise decent in some build-up sequences, linking play, etc. So yeah, as a whole, you have to say the midfield did do its job, and then the front three took over from there, really. On the theme of midfielders, Thomas, Duke McCool asked, do we miss Scott Arfield at all? I am going to say in one word, no.
Yeah, same. And no, he's not even playing with his club. And we just have so much options in the midfield, and guys like Liam Fraser and Piet are getting the job done. Witherspoon for the most part. So we missed Atiba Hutchinson, even though he was still in the official nomination as Kyle Larin was. So yeah, we don't miss him, no.
And, you know, what I think Canada missed in that Jamaica match was just playing more incisive, quickly, making runs off the ball. And guys like Junior Hoylett and Wotherspoon will provide that. And Arfield will connect play, carry the ball forward, and Canada, I feel, has enough of those guys. He doesn't do well as a playmaking 10. He thrives on making late runs in between the gaps, hitting a shot, and then maybe finding, you know, the fullback wide open towards the byline, really. And the fact he isn't playing much for Rangers really just means he doesn't deserve to be in the national team right now, simply put. Moving on to some questions about the next games in your hometown, Thomas. Paul Roach asking, what should one wear in Edmonton in November? And then Michael Friedland asking, can Canada sell out Commonwealth in November? What say you?
First question, if you don't have a parka, you better get one. you need some mittens for sure. You need some gloves under the mittens. Even two hats if necessary. And a hoodie under your parka. Yes, I'm not joking. This is true.
It's November.
Exactly. Yes, but it's still cold. It's still cold.
Oh, no, I know. I'm not disagreeing with you.
It's a different cold than Toronto.
Very different. Very different.
Toronto, you get a wind. There, it's a very dry cold. And it's bad. Second question, can Canada sell out at Commonwealth Stadium? Short answer, no. It's cold. It's November. 1 month anticipation, not 2 or 3 months. And yes, it's Alphonso Davies' homecoming and whatnot. But here's the thing. You're not trying to sell 30,000 tickets. You're trying to sell 54,000. Or at least 75% of that.
Right.
Whatever that number is. I don't have my calculator with me. Maybe you do. or whatever the Alberta regulations require. But yeah, that's that. I mean, it's going to be very, very difficult to sell it out because it's not a Grey Cup final. It's not a friendly against Brazil like they played in Edmonton in tune-up to the 1994 World Cup, which, by the way, was one of Canada's best games ever in the history of this national team.
It's not that.
It's not a FIFA U20 World Cup. It's not a Women's World Cup when it was held in Edmonton. So if it was in the summer, I would say yes, there's a chance for sure. But because it's in the winter, I think some people want to stay out. But I also know that Albertans like to go out regardless.
Yeah, because there's probably not much to do in Edmonton these days except watch the Oilers and, I don't know, I really have no idea what people do for fun in Edmonton in November. But I feel like they have a decent chance, do they not? Just because they're, I mean, just the Mexico game alone could possibly lead to a pretty packed stadium. But I feel like just because of how cavernous Commonwealth can be, you almost need to have an almost full stadium for it to really make an impact. So I think from a Canadian perspective, let's hope that happens, because if it's half empty and, you know, with the fans kind of far away from the field, that might not be too helpful in building what would be a strong atmosphere if it was sold out even. Because we saw the Women's World Cup. When that stadium was sold out, it was quite loud in there, despite the fact that the fans are far away from the pitch. Rounding out the show, Thomas, with a couple of questions here, maybe looking at some big picture stuff. Vince Alvarado asking, in your opinion, do these kinds of performances turn the heads of the likes of Kadioglu and Jebison? And even if it does, do Herdman's quotes throughout the Ocho about not really wanting to integrate any new players into the team means that we wouldn't see them anyway?
Kadioglu, it's tough because, yes, he's been contacted multiple times now, but by the CSA, which I appreciate the consistency there. But again, I mean, he's going to weigh out his chances with Turkey and Holland first and then Turkey second, and he's still playing in Turkey, so there's that. I think he will weigh out his options as long as he can. Maybe it's a similar situation with Eustáquio. He's going to play until his last eligible game as that U21 player, and then for senior, then he'll, you know, wait 6 months, a year, 2 years, and then see, okay, well, I can no longer play youth in UEFA competition. So, you know, if the national teams are not calling me up senior, then there's that. And Jebison, yes, I mean, this has to weigh in his mind. And Herman said that he wasn't open to new players, but he was forced to bring in new players regardless. Mm-hmm. So I think there's, you know, there's something to be said about both, really.
I think so. And maybe in January, when MLS players are out of season, maybe then the conversations with Jebison and others could rekindle, and then maybe they come in. Because by that point, they'll be halfway through their seasons in Europe, and Jebison is already starting to ramp up a little bit here with Burton Albion. He has Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank as his coach, and it's already paying dividends. Maybe by then he'll be in form and confident, and perhaps they can guarantee him a spot, especially if Lucas Cavallini continues to battle fitness problems. And I mean, obviously Kyle Larin's future is still uncertain after this year at Besiktas. Maybe once the Champions League's done and Besiktas doesn't get through to the Europa League or, you know, Champions League, maybe then he gets frozen out. Who knows? We just have no idea what can happen in a couple of months. So this will be interesting to see for sure. Finally, to close it out, Blair Donnelly, do you believe results from these first six matches will make other countries, players, and leagues take notice of this team long term, or will Canada need to qualify for this World Cup in order to make an impact? Thomas, as a fan of Peru, let me just say, even making a World Cup doesn't always guarantee that players get bigger and better moves all the time. But I think it's already happening with Canada when you just look at the amount of young players at European academies and in Europe in general right now, even if they're playing in second tier leagues right now. I think they're already taking notice, but certainly the better the national team does, maybe the more willing some of the other clubs are to buy those national team players. And then also, you know, scout for younger players in Canada and beyond. But really, the key is, at least for the established players, they have to do well at club level, because that is what matters. What they do with the national team matters far less than what they do with their club, at least in the eyes of potential suitors.
Yeah, 100%. And obviously, I want to elaborate on your point there. You mentioned Peru going to World Cup, and it did help Peru. I mean, there were players playing in Argentina that got moves to, you know, leagues like Spain. There were players playing in Turkey that maybe a sideline move, like a sideways move to MLS. Mm-hmm. But again, you have those kind of situations. And like we were saying in the middle of the show, like if these players weren't Canadian, they would be playing at much better clubs. And I think a guy like Johnston or a guy like Kamal Miller, they could do well in leagues like the Championship. Eustáquio could be playing for a Porto or a Napoli. There's just no record where this thing might go. You know, Kripo, maybe a mid-table league onside takes a chance on him. Like, there's just so many possibilities, and it does help. But again, if it doesn't happen, or it happens only to a few players where they do move up to bigger leagues, it's not the end of the world because, yes, Herman, when he took over in 2018, he said he did a study. Well, he looked at some studies, and to compete at a World Cup, you need a certain amount of tier one players on the field. And that's five or six tier one players. But there has to be said, too, like, Eustáquio is playing like a tier one player. He doesn't play in the top five league. Kayet sometimes looks like a tier one player. Buchanan looks like a tier one player. And he's going to be playing for Bruges. And obviously, I don't think he'll get a chance to play in the Champions League because obviously they're in the group of death with Bruges.
They're doing but well, you never though. Know. You never know.
You never know. You never know. But again, you don't have to. You don't have to be playing in top leagues to do it. I think the MLS has helped a lot. And the three Canadian MLS clubs have still contributed 7, 8, 9 players as well.
Very true. Very true for sure. So that will do it for us this week. Thank you everybody for listening. We will speak to you next week. Going to be weird without any post-match content to discuss, but we will do our best to give you the very best show that we can. So for Thomas Neff, I'm Peter Galindo. We will chat next week.